examining the issues. This is Unleashed with Mark Moreno on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Moreno on TNT. All right. One of America's one of America's most famous billionaires, Elon Musk, is now admitting or revealing inadvertently that the agenda has never been about getting you to drive an EV, never been about getting you to give up your gas-powered car in favor of this better technology, allegedly. It's been about giving up ownership of vehicles. And ride-sharing is the goal, abolishing the ownership. On this program, I've detailed to you how Boris Johnson's, in 2020, their transport minister said, we have to get rid of the idea, this outdated notion of the 20th century of owning a car. We have Andrew Yang, who ran for the Democrat Party nomination in 2020, and he said that we needed to get rid of abolish car ownership and everyone could just order up like a zip car or a car if you need it to go to the grocery store, or you can rent a car for the weekend if you need it to go to a store. We know that magazines like Business Insider have publicly stated in headlines and feature articles that the electric car is not the answer. We need to get rid of cars completely. We know that the goal behind the gas-powered car bans is vehicle rationing and making it more and more difficult to drive, to force you into public transit, to subways, to buses, trains, not airlines, because airlines, as we know, CNN has a goal of having carbon passports for airlines. BBC has said publicly, it's not a question of when, if, but when we can abolish all this flying, and cheap airlines have to be a thing of the past, according to Bloomberg News. So what Elon Musk did, this was inadvertently just sort of says it out there about the idea of what's happening here, is that cars are eventually going to just become, you know, you don't use your car that much. You really shouldn't own it. And we need to be sharing these across multiple people and events to make it more usable, because they're just sitting around doing nothing. It's wasteful. Clip one, Elon Musk, self-driving cars and car sharing.
I think the thing to appreciate is it's not that full self-driving will be as good as a person. It will be much, much better, like a lot, like over time, 10 times safer than a person. It's not even going to be a contest, frankly. So this is a really big deal. And I think some people realize it. I think you guys probably realize it. But being able to do a software update and have several million cars suddenly go from manual driving to autonomous, I think will be the single biggest asset value increase in history. The normal usage of a passenger car is roughly 10 to 12 hours per week, call it maybe an hour and a half per day. And when you drive around, you see lots of cars just parked in parking lots, because out of the 168 hours in a week, they're using less than 10%, maybe 7% of the hours of the week a car is in use. But once it is autonomous, it can be used probably, I don't know, 50 hours a week, maybe more. So it is effectively a fivefold increase in the value of a car overnight. I'm actually surprised that so few people realize this, or maybe they just don't believe it's real. But it is. So this is really an insanely big deal.
Potentially is an insanely big deal. First of all, do you want an autonomous car? I've seen stories on this very show on TNT about the havoc they've caused in America's streets, the accidents, and a lot of localities are banning them. They're just obviously not ready for prime time, number one. Number two, it's just another way for someone else to be in charge of your life. What if your autonomous car, which you're now sharing with people because your value's now gone up, it's a little unclear if he's saying that you won't own it or if you will be able to loan it out. Like, oh, hey, autonomous car, go do a shift of Lyft or Uber for me and make me some money. Go pick some people up and take them where they want to go and come back at 4 because I get off work. Again, this is like the last hour we had RFK Jr. talking about how AI needs to be severely controlled. This kind of technology needs to be severely controlled and all weigh all the intended and unintended consequences. In many cases in our society today, the intended consequences are worse than the unintended consequences. Used to be like, oh, their intentions were good. No, now their intentions aren't even good anymore. So anyway, we'll see where this goes with these autonomous vehicles. They kind of freak me out. Not necessarily opposed to new technology, but I am opposed when government corporate collusion get involved. And we already know that this ride sharing that Elon Musk is touting is another way of getting rid of us to abolish private car ownership. And by the way, it doesn't stop there. We played you a clip last week from the World Economic Forum. They want to abolish all ownership of appliances. It'll be cheaper for you and the companies. You'll just rent your washing machine, your dishwasher, your this or that. And who knows, in certain circumstances that might make sense. But remember, at the core of this isn't you'll have the choice of renting. It's we're going to take the option of ownership away from you. We have now a whole movement afoot to abolish private home ownership. Homes are worse for the climate. They want to get rid of the suburbs. They want to make everything high density and concentrate us in and get rid of any kind of land and spread out any kind of private property ownership like that. That's part of the UN Sustainable Development, the Biden administration, 30 by 30, 30% of the land's owned by the government, which is already happening. And before you say, oh, well, that's good, we should set aside this land, you're taking it away from localities and states who no longer have control, and people very far away are setting aside land, just like I reported on in Africa on this show. I was at the UN summit in Dubai, the climate summit, last December. And there was a report out of Financial Times, I believe it was, about how some nations in Africa, there were like five African nations, the poorest of the poor, where up to 20% of their land is now locked up by Western progressive liberals who are buying the land for carbon offsets so they can live the highest carbon footprint imaginable, private jets, multiple mansions. And poor Africans are no longer able to develop their land. They're losing their own sovereignty and land ownership as a people and a nation. So I just, Elon Musk, for all of his attributes on what he's helped with free speech battle, is he clueless on a lot of other stuff. And the Neuralink thing on the brain implants, we ought to do a show on that, what the research that Elon Musk is doing. Because once again, it's like the old, just remember the old Scooby-Doo adage, if only you'd use your powers for good instead of evil. Everything you invent or come up with, you have to really weigh. The line from Jurassic Park, the great dinosaur movie, the very first one, it was, what's the actor's name? Jeff Goldblum had said it. This is based on the Michael Crichton books. But he said, we spent all this time trying to invent something to see if we can, and we never asked the question whether we should. And I think that's sort of the thing here, whether you're talking about the brain link and how that could be abused, whether you're talking about AI, whether you're talking about self-driving autonomous cars. It's a scary world. All right, moving along. Jerry Seinfeld. I had a conversation with John Stossel. This is, I'm trying to think, it's like 2019. He was at an event in New York City. He was a speaker. And I've been up to New York many times with him and interviewed, and he's featured me on his program. And I debated Bill Nye on his old Fox show. But anyway, he was telling me, we were talking always about Jerry Seinfeld. And I always said, I believe Jerry Seinfeld is somewhat of a conservative. He's not a Hollywood liberal. And he said, well, he lives in the same building with me. And I said hi to him many times, but he's never engaged me in politics. We never knew. Jerry Seinfeld is now finally speaking out. He's always spoken out about college campuses and about the lack of free speech, and he doesn't get into the drama. And a couple things happened recently. And there's an interview I believe I played on this show where Jerry Seinfeld, actor, comedian, chastised someone who said there wasn't enough DEI equity on the old Seinfeld show from the 90s, that there wasn't enough black characters. And he said, no, comedy's comedy. I wasn't counting races and faces. He really pushed back hard. Well, first of all, this is Jerry Seinfeld because of his support of Israel. This is what happened to him in New York City this week. This is clip two. And then I'll set up this next clip on free speech where Jerry Seinfeld's sounding off on the extreme left. But let's go with clip two. This is what Jerry Seinfeld's now being attacked. Jerry Seinfeld has never been at the center of controversy, I'm aware of, is now being attacked by the pro-Hamas protesters in New York City. Clip two.
I support her! Free Palestine!
You support Jerry
supporter!
That's Jerry Seinfeld. He's apparently a vocal supporter of Israel, and he's now got himself involved in that controversy. And these are protests from the left. These are Hamas and supporters of Palestinians, and almost exclusively on the left. But yeah, there's some conservatives you get, you know, libertarians who want to keep the U.S. out of the Middle East. Anyway, Seinfeld is dealing with that. So in this next clip, I don't know if what came first, the chicken or the egg, but this is the first time I'm aware of where Jerry Seinfeld is using the phrase extreme left. And he says PC crap is killing comedy today. So this is clip three, Jerry Seinfeld really getting political for the first time I've ever seen it, other than his stand defense of free speech, which is inherently political, but still not explicitly. Clip three, Jerry Seinfeld railing on the extreme left.
It used to be you would go home at the end of the day. Most people would go, oh, Cheers is on. Oh, MASH is on. Oh, Mary Tyler Moore is on. All in the Family's on. You just expected there'll be some funny stuff we can watch on TV tonight. Well, guess what? Where is it? Where is it? This is the result of the extreme left and PC crap and people worrying so much about offending other people. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to see stand-up comics because we are not policed by anyone. The audience polices us. We know when we're off track. Mm-hmm. We know instantly, and we adjust to it instantly. But when you write a script and it goes into four or five different hands, committees, groups, here's our thought about this joke, well, that's the end of your comedy.
Have you had that experience?
No.
Because isn't that what Curb is all about?
Yeah. Larry was grandfathered in. He's old enough that I don't have to observe those rules because I started before you made those rules.
I love it. First of all, that's a Seinfeld I've never heard before. Again, getting that political, I welcome it. This is exciting. And I love what he says about Larry David. Larry David, probably that Curb Your Enthusiasm is probably one of my favorite all-time shows. Next to The Honeymooners, Odd Couple, Police Squad, and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And then more distantly, Seinfeld. And Curb Your Enthusiasm is a show that just speaks to me. I love that show, Larry David's HBO show. I have not watched the final season yet. I plan to. But I love that, just the idea that he's grandfathered in. Oh, those rules don't apply to me because I started before you made the rules. I mean, that's Larry Davidism. Larry David's a huge liberal too, but he has a way with comedy. He gets it. He's done many shows on Trump and Trump supporters. I find myself laughing my head off. When I was in the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, Barbara Boxer was the chair of the committee, and she went and appeared on a Larry David as a guest star in a limited role. Did a skit about dry cleaning, some environmental event. And I remember talking to her in the ante room in front of Senator Inhofe's staff, who I worked for, the Republican staff. And I said, oh, that was very good. I saw you on Larry David last week. I go, I love that show. And that was funny, your bit. And Barbara Boxer lit up. By the way, she offered me a job. We took a trip to Greenland on a congressional. Senator Inhofe couldn't go. And she said, if I ever switch sides, she'd love to hire me. We had a lot of fun. There's a picture of me and her together having a great time in Greenland, of all places. She's now retired and left, but big liberal too. Not like her politically at all. But she... I remember the staff, even the GOP staff was like, what? Why is Mark talking to Barbara Boxer? And why is he basically praising her? And why is she all excited to talk to him about her TV show? It's funny. They thought I was sucking up to Barbara Boxer. But anyway, it's funny. But Jerry Seinfeld, the other thing to understand about him right now, and just keep your eye on him, he's doing some new show, and I have no idea what network, but he's bringing Michael Richards, the man who played Kramer on Seinfeld. Now, Michael Richards got canceled in Hollywood about 5, 6, 7 years ago. He was in a comedy club and got heckled by, I guess, an African-American black person, and started responding with the N-word repeatedly and had an N-word meltdown. And his career was basically over. Stand up, he was vilified. Jerry Seinfeld stood behind him quietly, supported him quietly. But now Jerry Seinfeld's got a new show. He wanted Michael Richards to come on, and whoever the network said, "Oh no, you can't." He said all these words, and Jerry Seinfeld said, I don't care." It was years ago. The guy's a great comic, and he said what he said. He apologized, and I'm not doing it unless he joins us. And he got his way. He got Michael Richards to join the show over the network's objection. So Jerry Seinfeld, it's very hard not to be red-pilled. I showed you the left attacking him, calling him genocide supporter. I showed you his attack on the extreme left. I'm telling you the whole history and my conversation with John Stossel, lived in the same building with Jerry Seinfeld. This is not the same Jerry Seinfeld of 10 years ago. I'm telling you, just keep your eye on him and also keep your eye on his comedy. I bet this show is going to have a little bit of an edge now and pushing back and mocking some of this PC extreme left political crap that's killing comedy in Jerry Seinfeld's word. Okay. I got to move along. I got way too bogged down in this. This is British MP Andrew Brigden, London, making a shock claim. I talked in the last hour with the doctor about the vaccines and whether she recommends them. She said no. She wouldn't recommend them to children. She wouldn't recommend them to 90-year-olds, the COVID vaccine. Well, this is the shock claim. He's claiming that more people have died in the Holocaust because of these, that more people have died from the vaccines than they did during the Holocaust. I have no idea if it's true. It's probably violating all sorts of political correctness to even suggest something like this. But here it is for your own analysis, and you can make up your own mind. Clip four.
Do you think people are now coming around? Because you've been fighting to have this debate for quite a while, haven't you?
Well, the evidence was pretty considerable 18 months ago when I first spoke out. I mean, it's overwhelming now. Every week there's more evidence. Paper out last week in Japan of a clear link now between people who've had the boosters and increased cancer. We know why. It's the SV40, the simian virus 40 promoter region that Pfizer didn't disclose in their vaccines. I mean, there's a clear link with promoting cancer.
And so are you seeing more MPs now than before coming to your party?
No, the MPs have got their hands in the blood up to their armpits, most of them. They have put out thousands, hundreds if not thousands of letters saying that the vaccines are safe and effective over the last few years. There's a general election coming later this year, and they really just want to hold the line until after the general election, because there is, on both sides of the house, there's so much political capital that the vaccines are safe and effective, which they're neither safe nor effective. I was thrown out of the Conservative Party for tweeting that a leading cardiologist had said that the vaccine rollout is the biggest crime against humanity since the Holocaust. I'm afraid I think it's going to be bigger than the Holocaust, because I think we've got to be somewhere between 10 and 20 million people have been killed by these experimental vaccines worldwide, and it's still going on.
Wow. And that was... British MP Andrew Brigden, London, and make that shock claim. I'm not going to comment. That's for you to decide. I report, you decide. All right. Ursula von der Leyen, just a reminder, 2021, she wants to make that vaccine, the COVID vaccine, mandatory. This is Ursula von der Leyen, the EU head on vaccine mandates. Clip five.
We have this horrible pandemic. We have the vaccines, the life-saving vaccines, but they are not being used adequately everywhere. And thus, this costs, of course, an enormous health cost coming along. If you look at the numbers, we have now 77% of the adults in the European Union vaccinated, or if you take the whole population, it's 66%. And this means one third of the European population is not vaccinated. These are 150 million people. This is a lot. And not each and everyone can be vaccinated. So there are very small children, for example, or people with special medical conditions, but the vast majority could. And therefore, I think it is understandable and appropriate to lead this discussion now. How we can encourage and potentially think about mandatory vaccination within the European Union. This needs discussion. This needs a common approach, but it is a discussion that I think has to be led.
Imagine the failure of big public health, 150 million people not getting the vaccine. What a catastrophe. We need to force them. That's the first instinct of any totalitarian bureaucrat. And make no mistake, that is what the WHO pandemic treaty, one of the core messages of that is they want to force medical procedures on you in total violation of the Nuremberg Code after World War II of the horrors of Nazi Germany. Okay, we have to take a break. And when we come back, a familiar face, Lembit Opik, will be joining the program. He was a guest host for me last week when I made my trek out to San Diego, 2 weeks ago, San Diego, California. He's a presenter here on TNT, his weekend show, and he's a former MP in the UK. So we'll ask him about that. We're going to have a fun talk about a whole bunch of different things. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
TNT's Rick Munn.
People are, terrified. What happens if the internet goes down? What happens if we can't get online? What happens if this? Listen, we've been around for millennia with no mobile phones. There's been revolutions in the past with no mobile phones. Wars have been won in the past with no mobile phones, okay? So we use them. Don't let them use you, but don't worry too much about it if things get shut down, because we've always got people, real physical people, inhabiting a real physical world there. So that's a little timely reminder of that.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk TNT Radio should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program should be a familiar face since he guest hosted, Lembit Opik, presenter here on TNT. He's also a former MP of the UK from 1997 to 2010. He was the shadow secretary also for the state of Northern Ireland, helped negotiate their peace. Welcome back to the program, Lembit.
Great to be back. Good to see you. And thanks for letting me stand in for you a couple of weeks ago. I didn't do as good a job as you, but it's great to be your number two.
All right. Well, I was going to say, you know, it's always dangerous when you have a guest host. My mom, who watches this show, literally said, oh, I got it, was enjoying your program so much. When I called her from California, one of the times she actually said to me, oh, I got to go. Your show's on. This guy is so funny. I'm like, oh, who's I go, who the interview? She's like, oh, the guest host. She actually cut the conversation short. So it gave me, you know, it's one of the things you got to think about. You don't want someone who's going to entertain the audience more than the host when you're picking a guest host. So I violated a rule there, but thank you for filling in. So
you're a brother from another mother. That's all, the way I look at it. You know, I'll never steal your presents at Christmas or Thanksgiving, as you would say.
All right. Well, let's start with the probing question. Who is Lembit Opik? Where did you come from? How did you end up at TNT? Tell us your history. I see here that you were a British member of Parliament. That's fascinating. We'll just start with a little bit about your background, your education, and then how you became a British member of Parliament.
Well, I was born in Northern Ireland, which is one part of the UK, but my parents are Estonian, which is why I'm called Lembit Opik, which by an amazing coincidence is actually an anagram of the phrase, I like to be MP. Who knew? And then I went to... I know it's true. You work it out later. Don't do it now. So I went to a school in Northern Ireland, went to Bristol University, a fantastic British educational institution where you were allowed to think for yourself. Then I worked for a massive multinational called Procter & Gamble, which was an American company, which did something fairly innocent. It just cleaned your clothes. And then I went into Parliament, which was perhaps less innocent and even more engaging. And I spent 13 years there, as you said. Now, obviously, like you, I'm honored to be part of the stable of today's News Talk TNT, which is all about freedom, because I am actually a libertarian.
Yes. I always consider myself a cross between libertarian and conservative. Okay, so that where are you currently residing then? Are you in the UK, the United States? Where do you live?
I'm in London, and I don't see a contradiction between being a conservative and a libertarian, because I would say conservative means free market. It's not so much about freedom. A libertarian means not being an authoritarian. In terms of where I live, well, I'm a citizen of the world. I was actually in Dallas a few weeks ago to watch the total solar eclipse, a fantastic thing that I saw there. And then I went to Colorado Springs. What a beautiful place. America is so much more attractive than drizzly London. So if you want to swap, I'll certainly give you my place. We can have a house share, whatever you want to do. And also I want to thank you for the Marshall Plan, which pretty much bailed out Europe about 80 years ago.
I was in London, October 2022, most recently, with Lord Christopher Monckton. We spoke at a renewable energy conference. We had a debate, and I was at the old Dorchester Hotel in London. Beautiful place. They even had a rooftop reception up there. And it was famous for something. I want to say someone committed suicide. What's the Dorchester, if you remember what it's famous for? I can't remember. Some celebrity. There's a lot of lore associated with that hotel. But I was impressed, by the way. London did not look like New York, San Francisco, L.A. It looked relatively clean, relatively crime-free, graffiti-free. What's going on? London hasn't gone woke like many U.S. cities?
Be careful. I got my phone stolen twice in 4 months. Right in central London, near Trafalgar Square. On one occasion, my phone was stolen outside the police station in Charing Cross. At least it made it quick to report. But on the upside, it does have history. It wasn't bombed to pieces. The big picture here is, though, that there probably is still a certain heritage, but an assumption in the UK that we still run a big empire. I'm not convinced about that. I think America's got a bigger empire than the UK. But I suppose if you argue that your children create everything that you own, then we own America.
There you go. I like that. when you see your phone,
it's wistful. I don't mean it. It's wistful. I'm Estonian for the purpose of that comment.
Okay. When you say your phone was stolen, was it like a pickpocket or a snatch and grab, or you left it at a table and someone took it? What kind of crime are we talking here?
Well, two crimes. The first one, I was surrounded by four knife-wielding individuals.
Ooh, okay, that's U.S. style crime, by the way. What's that doing in London? Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No guns, but I reckon I would have been stabbed if I hadn't given them my phone. They sort of grabbed it, and I did, in some sort of an egotistical alpha male way, chase after them, but I knew I wasn't as fast as the bicycle, so I survived that. The second time was even worse. I was in a coffee shop away from the door, and this 15-year-old girl came in, grabbed my phone, and knew that if I chased after her, the gang, which had also followed her in, would steal everything else that I had. So I had to pack my stuff away. And obviously, by the time I went outside, the phone had gone. So these are, in a way, passive crimes because I wasn't harmed. But London is not as safe as you would expect. And the truth is, Mark, today a 13-year-old individual was stabbed to death in part of London with a big knife, big sword, I believe. Actually, I saw the vague details today. So it's a problem. But, you know, at the end of the day, you and I both live in countries which are comparatively safe because neither America nor the UK is planning to invade each other.
Right. And my experience in London in 2022 was the touristy districts. You know, I went through Buckingham Palace area and Trafalgar Square and Big Ben and the Dorchester Hotel, as I mentioned. But everything seemed weird. Everything seemed fine. And that's a strange thing. I can't imagine here in the U.S. I don't know anyone who's had their cell phone taken anywhere. It just doesn't seem like a high. You know, when I grew up, we always had car radios stolen. And my old Jeep had a car. I had a CD player, one of the first ones. It was broken into and stolen. And just, you don't hear about that stuff anymore. It just seems like, you know, I guess, I don't know, maybe because in America we have more guns, they go for the bigger ticket items. I just wouldn't even think of someone stealing my cell phone. My laptop,
Because everyone's stolen all the CDs and now we've got to something else. And if you actually steal the radio from my car, you have to steal the whole car. And that's pretty heavy to carry.
Well, they designed that. All right. So what made you run for MP and what were the issues? You were there from 97 to 2010. What were the issues you dealt with? This would have been, I want to say, Tony Blair era. Is that correct?
I got elected the same day that Tony Blair became the prime minister. And okay. I wasn't in the same party, but I did feel quite optimistic at the time because we'd had a very dysfunctional government at the time, the Conservatives. And then Blair came along and he seemed to be cool Britannia. And I'll have to say for the first couple of years, it really felt like that. What motivated me to go into Parliament was libertarianism, about giving people their freedom back, legalizing all drugs and regulating them, because I don't think that you can ban addiction. You can treat it, but you can't ban it. Also, the idea that you can do pretty much whatever you want to do as long as you don't harm other people. I felt that British politics had gone a long way from that agenda. I wanted to drag us back there. What was it like? Well, it was disappointing. I think for the first 5 years, I felt quite optimistic. I felt that we were making progress. We made the museums of Britain free again. The Tories had made them a pay privilege, really. But what frustrated me was the fact that the politicians increasingly wanted to serve themselves. Why? Because we ended up with a political class, people who hadn't done anything else and people who just wanted to be politicians. They didn't really have a narrative. People like Benazir Bhutto, Gandhi, JFK, you could argue, they wanted to achieve an outcome. These people wanted to be politicians. Once that happens, Mark, then you compromise your values because you haven't got any. And I think that's the mess that Britain's in now.
Wow. So, you know, fast forwarding, what did you think of Boris Johnson as the UK PM? I was all excited when he was, I guess, the mayor of London. And I heard, oh, a climate skeptic is running and he becomes prime minister. And I, you know, as far as I can tell, and I don't follow that, the ins and outs of this, but his wife's name was Fanny. He met her. She was a big environmental activist. She converted him and he became like, you know, an apologist for the for the climate. I mean, he became like the biggest climate activist, saying the most inane things, saying he needed to get in touch with his feminine side to fight climate. We need a more feminine government. He was saying all kinds of weird stuff. What happened to, in your view, of Boris Johnson? How would you rate him as a leader?
A caveat here. First of all, I got get on well with him at a personal level, but I mean, basically, I don't want to get you in trouble then.
Yeah, but yeah.
No, it's all right. I haven't seen him for a while. I was just going to impersonate him anyway. He won't like this, but I used to realize that this wasn't a problem, but now that my wife made me realize that it is a problem. But if I could say it in Latin, I mean, well, they didn't have climate problems then. That's the way it is. And I was robbed. The practical situation about Boris is he's easy to impersonate, but hard to understand. He actually had it right when he got elected. He didn't believe there was a climate emergency. Then his darling wife decided to rule the roost, and then he came up with this unbelievable trash when it's perfectly obvious to anybody who is scientifically literate in any way that human beings can't be really changing the climate. It's just so egotistical of our species to think that we can. And he was just grasping at straws, trying to be populist, and that's what sunk him. The other thing he did wrong was he told us all, and you were talking about the COVID vaccination scandal and the scandemic, we all had to be locked down, and then he ignored it himself. People hate hypocrisy. In every country, they hate hypocrisy. And he was getting people prosecuted for breaking the law, and then he got prosecuted himself. That was an unwinnable situation. At that point, he'd signed his own resignation letter.
Yeah, and I remember him when he was on climate, he did all the world summits. He was just pushing, and it was such a sad reversal. One of the things, it was 2019, I believe, he was talking about pouring cement into the fracking wells of the UK to sort of show the symbolism of, you know, being in the United with net zero. What kind of impact is England going through right now? I mean, do they wish they had not gone so net zero and wish they had done more domestic energy and not relied on foreign sources of energy?
Not yet. Those of us who understand the energy crisis, which has been created by this totally undeliverable renewable energy scam, recognized that the energy prices in the UK are so high because of these stupid policies. The general public is slowly catching up. They recognize that they don't want to vote for a party which is going to sell them down the river in terms of 100% or 200% increase in energy costs. But there's still one connection to be made. The public still sort of accept that there's a climate crisis. There's one very big witness which will convert British thinking on that. The climate, because it's not cooperating. We've got frost in Scotland at the end of April. That just doesn't happen. But of course, the climate catastrophists tell us all of this is because of climate change. Well, it's getting colder, folks. So in that sense, Boris Johnson did a massive disservice to himself by being a hypocrite and I would say a liar when it came to the question of COVID. And then a turncoat when it came to the science of the environment and climate change. The good news is climate will eventually prove that it's not going crazy. And I hope the public have woken up to the fact that we shouldn't let people put poison on our bodies. As a victim of the third vaccination myself, I will never take one again.
Wow. Yeah, the vaccine is a whole separate, that's a mess. Well, I do want to talk about COVID in a minute, but one other thing. In 2019, there was a thing called the UK Fires Report, and it was government funded. I remember reading the House of Commons, or maybe it was the House of Lords, transcript. And every member of parliament, now this is long after you'd left, but they all accepted the premise of a climate crisis, including the so-called conservatives. They all accepted the goals of net zero, didn't challenge it, but they basically said, well, this report went too far. And this report was truly bonkers. It was calling for a ban on new airports, 90% meat reductions, basically laid out what looked like a COVID lockdown, but in the name of climate. This was 2019. So my question is, what is the deal with the opposition party or the conservative party in England that on climate? Why do they all accept the narrative? Why do they all accept the net zero goals? Why are they so weak? At least in America, we have politicians that challenge the premise. We have congressional hearings going after the scientific claims. It just seems like England gave up the fight. Is there anyone left that was willing in elected office that's willing to actually fight the premise of climate crisis and of net zero?
Well, three questions there. The reason they bought it is because they're stupid. They don't understand science. It's just like, I can't put it in any more respectful way than that. When you ask a politician, what percentage of the atmosphere is CO2? They go, oh, 12, 50. When you go 0.04, they say, I'm wrong. Where do you go with that? The second thing that's happened is we've got this uni party. The Labour Party and the Conservatives are pretty much the same party now. Keir Starmer, who's the leader of the Labour Party and likely to be the next Prime Minister, he's actually, in a way, even worse than Rishi Sunak, the current Prime Minister, because he still clings to these ridiculous climate targets. And on the third one, well, I'll answer it in a slightly obtuse way, but hopefully it will make sense. What has to happen is the public need to recognize that their standard of living is going to be utterly destroyed for no benefit to the environment, for no benefit to the climate. What we've done in this country, Mark, is we've actually exported our CO2 production to China. They make all the stuff that we used to make, and then we buy it back. And they make more CO2. You said it yourself. They're making two coal-fired power stations every week. Which is good for the climate and good for the country and good for the world, because it actually makes the world a bit greener, because CO2 is the food of life. We say that often in TNT. So I can add all that up into one sentence. We've got crazy politicians who live in a vanilla sky world who don't understand the science, and the public is, I desperately hope, waking up from woking down.
Well, a blunt question. Is there a conservative leader, anyone in Europe right now, elected in the UK, sorry, not Europe, who is just like, there is no climate crisis and hell no to the net zero agenda. We need to abolish it. Does anyone have the courage? Is there any leader, minor party, rural area, anyone that, are there a coalition? Is there anyone saying that kind of a thing, or they're just all silent or bought into it?
There are a few. Nigel Farage, who's a big friend of the United States.
But he's not in power now, Trump. Is he?
No, but he's, you let me talk about the minority parties too, but okay, we can talk about the big ones.
Well, I'm just saying anyone in power. I just mean anyone who's elected currently is what I'm getting at. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Talk about Nigel Farage. I saw he was debanked by a major bank for his views on climate change. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, but somebody lost their job over that. Okay, let's talk about the people in power. Yeah. Really good question, actually, Mark. There's a woman called Penny Mordaunt, and she is tipped to be the next leader of the Conservatives. I think she will be the next leader of the Conservatives when they lose the general election. And mark my words, they will lose that election. I think she wants to rein back on it. I know her entourage. They are climate change realists. They recognize that human race is not frying the world. And unlike what the head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, says, the earth is not boiling. So I think if she gets in, we'll have an opposition party that takes this view. Secondly, we've got this idiotic future prime minister, Keir Starmer, who will carry on headlong into this abyss of climate policy, but he can't deliver it. And so at some point, he'll have to say, well, now that we're in government, we've seen the books, we've seen the inside, and we can't possibly carry out the climate change agenda. And so he'll back off by blaming the Conservatives. But OK, as long as he backs off, that's fine. Now, turning to the small parties, the truth is that Nigel Farage is very influential, even though he's not a member of parliament, because they're probably going to take between 10 and 15% of the vote, mostly from the Conservatives. He can wag the dog of politics. What's really interesting, Mark, is what happens after the next election. It'll have to be a realignment on the right. And I think that's when Nigel Farage, the man who delivered Brexit, the exit from the EU to the United Kingdom, that's when he'll charge his price and the Tories will have to pay it.
Well, do you ever see him as a potential? Could he win prime minister one day, Nigel Farage, or is this the system skewed against it? How would he go about doing that?
It's unlikely because, as you say, the answer's contained in your question. The system is skewed against his prime ministerial bid. But I think he could be very influential in the future because he can charge his price for the 2030 or 2029 general election. By simply saying, well, unless you agree with this, we're going to stand again and we're going to get even more. So he would be quite a good prime minister, but he's unlikely to be the prime minister. He'll be the hand that rocks the cradle.
Okay. All right. We have to take a break. We're talking with Olympic Opik, a TNT presenter, and a former UK member of parliament. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. When we come back, I want to ask you about Lindsay Hoyle. And his famous comment about how compliant the public was during COVID lockdowns, and he'd like to now turn to climate to have the same kind of policies. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We'll be right back after these messages.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days. They haven't drank anything. They're cold, they're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud. Just absolutely mud.
So the country has been in prolonged drought so long, it was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution, and we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution, one rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
One in four Australian women experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Staying is dangerous, but leaving can mean homelessness for them and their children. With your generosity, the Salvos can provide crisis services and ongoing support, helping women find a way out of violence and a way back into a safe and stable life. Help us leave no one in need. Please donate to the Red Shield Appeal today.
Unleashing the Beast. Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're continuing our talk with Alembic Opik, fellow TNT presenter, also guest host for here on Unleashed. Okay, a question here. This is a name I've used and since 2020, never heard of him before that, but Lindsay Hoyle is the Speaker of the House of Commons there in the UK. In 2020, I believe this was maybe late September, October 2020, he marveled at the compliance in England of the COVID lockdowns and mandates. And he said he was amazed at how, quote, compliant the public was, and that now was the time before COVID ended to switch over and try to do the same thing for climate. And we've had many other famous, you know, climate activists. John Kerry said COVID and climate, the responses are the same, the problems are similar. We had the teen climate activist from Teen Vogue say actually out loud in the magazine, if we can shut down the world for a virus, we can do the same thing for climate change. But was Lindsay Hoyle right? Was the UK public very compliant during COVID? And would they be as compliant with a climate style lockdown? And here in the US, we're talking about, I'll ask you that next about the climate emergency. But what about Lindsay Hoyle? Was the UK compliant? And would the public in the UK and England go along with a version of a climate lockdown?
On that first point, the UK public were brilliant at looking compliant. I live slightly in the country. I mean, this is the great thing about this. I live in the country. There must be about 20 gardens within 100 meters or 200 meters of my house. Every day during the lockdown, I could hear parties. These people were not sober. These people were not socially distancing. Like, if you could hear hugs, I would be deafened by now. So they went, yeah, we're going to do all this, mate. And then they just ignored it. And weirdly, the world didn't die. Britain didn't die. As you said before, you implied before, the real problem is the vaccinations. That's what's been killing people. So no, we didn't comply, but we pretended we did. And then the worst thing was the Prime Minister himself and the Secretary of State for Health. A friend of mine, I've got to admit, Matt Hancock, was filmed on CCTV snogging his girlfriend in violation to the very same rules, causing him to say, well, no, this is family, which caused other problems with his wife, but we won't go down that path right now.
And then hey, family is who you're with at the moment, right? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, the family I'm with at the moment, yeah. You could basically have used that, an interesting loophole which he created. And then we've got Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker of the House, using a word I loathe, complicit, compliance. Yeah. I hate that word, as if it's a compliment to say, oh, yeah, people will follow like sheep. And the other part of you, what you've said, yes, the public is trusting. Most people tend to trust authority. And they go, well, if we're told there's a climate crisis, there must be, even though all the evidence suggests that it's nonsense. But most people don't study science and climatology like you and I do. So they follow it because they want to be able to trust the people who lead them. And here's the big irony. These politicians aren't the leaders. They're our servants. And then they ignored the rules that they were trying to impose on us. So I think the whole thing's crumbling now, Mark, because with COVID, we were given a case study in hypocrisy. That's the way I'd put it. And now with the climate non-emergency, these people fly around the world to tell us not to fly. Emma Thompson, an actress I didn't really like beforehand, but I certainly don't respect now, flew to the United Kingdom from across the Atlantic to tell us that there's a climate emergency and we need to not fly. That is what's going wrong. Hoyle talked, in my view, nonsense. It was offensive about compliance when it came to COVID. I just hope we can transpose the lessons we learned from the hypocrisy into not following when it comes to the non-existent climate emergency.
All right. Now, it says here you were born in Northern Ireland to Estonian parents, but you were part of this, helped negotiate the UK-Ireland, or the, I guess, England-Ireland peace. You were a shadow What's the phrase again? Shadow.
Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland.
Yeah. That's it.
This doesn't roll off the tongue, but it sounds good.
Okay. But to an American, we don't even understand, Ireland. What are they fighting over? What is this, like the Middle East? Is this like Palestine and Israel? So in a few sentences, educate us on what your role was. What's the beef between Ireland and England? Condense it down. I think we only have about a minute or two left, a couple minutes left. But what exactly was your role and what was the beef and how did you help bring it around?
I can do this in 60 seconds, Mark.
Go ahead.
But it's my opinions. Viewers, you need to check what I'm about to say. England liked to try to control the island of Ireland. It's a separate bit of land. It didn't run it very well. People hated England. They got their independence about 100 years ago. So then most of Ireland was on its own. One bit of Ireland was still part of the UK. And then there was a whole lot of argument, a whole lot of fighting. And then there was a deal which stopped the fighting. And that was basically what I was involved with. The fact is, in the north of Ireland, Catholics were persecuted. They were not persecuted as badly as Benjamin Netanyahu does in Gaza. But if you're Catholic, you had a bum deal. And that was fixed to an extent. It's still not perfect, but it's not bad. And I was part of talking to the former terrorists to try to make that deal. It's probably the most important thing I've done in my life, to be honest with you, Mark. 3,200 people died in those troubles, which is still less than a tenth of the number of people who died in Gaza. But it's a large proportion of people for the small country that the north of Ireland is. Does it matter? Yeah, it does. It means that sometimes talking can do better than shooting. And sometimes politicians get it right.
Wow. I mean, that really is, that's a great resume story right there. That's phenomenal. Is this going to stick like decades from now? And, and also that's one question. Second, is there animosity generally between Irish people and English people, or do they generally get along and it's just a small sect of each that have these battles?
Second question first, most people get on, even the people who didn't like each other politically got on well in pubs. There's a huge pub culture in the north of Ireland, actually in the whole of Ireland, and much more communicates between Catholics and Protestants. That was the theoretical religious distinction than between anyone from Ireland and England. So people generally do get on pretty well. On to the first question. Yes, it will stick, but here's the irony. There is a clause in all of this settlement which says that if the north of Ireland, which is still part of the UK, wants to be part of the south of Ireland, which is a different country, we can have a referendum to decide that. I'd say in 30 years' time, you said a few decades, that's what's going to happen. Will it make a difference? Yeah, it'll probably settle a wrong which has been there for half a millennium. Will it be popular? The Protestants will hate it. But at the end of the day, that's democracy, and that's basically what you have to suck up if you actually are a Democrat.
Wow. All right. Now, as I just want to get this name right, the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, if you were called up, and I think we only have a minute left, and they said, hey, we need your expertise in the Middle East, how would you bring peace between Israel and Palestine? And you have 45 seconds. Do it eloquently, do it concisely with all the historical references you need. Go.
I would say, Benjamin Netanyahu, you don't get the bucks unless you sit at this table. To the people in Palestine, I say, I know you feel wronged and hurt. Sit down with the guys you hate and let's start talking. And then I'd say, we did it in Northern Ireland. Nelson Mandela did it in South Africa. We're all humans on a tiny little planet. We haven't got long on this earth. Let's just sit down with people we hate and do something for the people that we love.
Wow. Lempic, OPIC, I'm impressed. You need to have an agent to market yourself as a peace negotiator around the world. I mean, that was incredible.
I just need a show on TNT. I've got it.
There you go.
Listen to me on Saturday and Sunday.
Thank you. On Saturday and Sunday, Lempic OPIC, fellow TNT host, guest host here on Unleashed. We appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. See you soon.
All right. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.